Welcome to The Story Goes. Today's episode, Teresa. Teresa is bold, smart, creative, and kind. Her level of excellence is often unmatched. Today, she wanted to talk about believing in yourself and the ability to heal.
Yeah, so I'm Teresa, and I think the first thing that you need to know about me is that my mom was just diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer. This is very new and very big, and it's just that big, scary C word that has come into my family's life all of a sudden. So healing, the possibility of healing, is very much on the mind right now. The second thing that you need to know about me is that I had a mental breakdown in my second year in college, and that is something that has impacted me my entire life up until today, and it's just left this huge tremor, this huge impact, and it's been something that I've had to work with for a very long time. So healing is also something that has been a very deeply personal and important journey for me as well.
These big moments swirling together in her life have compelled her to want to share her journey with us today.
I'm just signing up to completely spill my guts for the world to listen. What could possibly go wrong?
This episode contains some heavy topics. Though not discussing every detail of her trauma, we will talk through, among other things, thoughts of suicide, death, and eating disorders. This is your trigger warning. Before we get into it, let's understand who Teresa is. An incredible overachiever, her life before college was small town, conservative, and often beautiful.
I grew up in this very small town called Loyalton, California. And Loyalton's big claim to fame is that Atlas Obscura dubbed them the loneliest town in America. And I would say that that's like a pretty accurate moniker for the town that I grew up in. And Loyalton was this place that was like supposed to be this bedroom community of Tahoe, has like always had these like grand aspirations. And so going throughout the world, that has always been my cover. I can just say, oh, I grew up near Lake Tahoe. And people are like, oh, second homes and vacation. Great. Loyalton always wanted to be tap into that sort of wealth and opulence, to be this place that people would come and vacation and ski. And it never is gonna be that. It's hard to describe a little bit where Loyalton is, but you basically can't even get lost and end up there. You would have to take so many wrong turns from Tahoe to actually end up in Loyalton. And so when I grew up there, the population was around 1,200 people. And that declined precipitously to around 800 people because the mill, the logging mill, closed in the 90s. I think the mill closed because that spotted owl environmental legislation got passed. And so it just radicalized a whole group of conservatives.
All 800 people that were left.
Yeah. So that is the setting under which I grew up. And at the same time, it was this gorgeous place. The Sierra Valley, where Loyalton is this high alpine valley. It's at 5,000 feet elevation, but then it's surrounded by the Sierra Nevadas. So it's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous place to be, even though it's so economically depressed and has been losing population steadily since the 90s, at least.
In her town, Teresa participated in all the clubs, sports, drama, you name it. She stood out.
I think my class had around 37 people in it. The entire high school had, I believe, like 150, and people would bus in to Loyalton. Like, we were the big town where people would come to go to school.
So many beautiful cliches.
There's not even a stoplight in the town.
But there were other parts too. Great parts.
I had this incredible group of little kids, and we basically had the run of the place. Our house backed up against National Forest. So it was literally like just be home by 6. You know, so we as this group of kids, we would run off into the hills and we would play these really wonderful games of imagination. We would put on elaborate plays. And in a lot of ways, it was a very idyllic childhood in the sense that there was so much connection with nature. There was so much imagination and exploration and a really good group of kids running around. And I think that there was a lot going on under the surface that was really difficult and really challenging.
What stood out to me was the depression of this town, surrounded by incredible beauty. What support was there for someone like Teresa? Did she know just how isolated things were?
I think I became pretty aware pretty fast. Where things started to get tough for me was high school. My parents were going through a really difficult divorce at the time, and my sister had gone away to college, and this all got hard pretty fast.
Life became more complicated. The town she grew up in, quite conservative, didn't accept divorce as an option. Teresa was raised Catholic. That didn't help things.
Something like divorce was just not on the table. It was not something that was even considered.
For wanting the divorce, her mother was ostracized. And Teresa was also, by extension. With her sister away at school, her community was dwindling. And yet, she still excelled.
I played soccer. I did track. I did drama. I played classical piano. You know, I would have been valedictorian, but I decided to graduate early. And I would have been valedictorian of the class that I joined, too. But I had a sense of self-preservation for my social life and decided that was not worth it.
On the surface, Teresa was thriving. She had great friends, was popular. She was unfazed by the turmoil at home, right?
I had a lot of friends, but I have felt very alone in a group. You know, I felt like nobody understood what I was going through, and I felt really alone. I felt really alienated.
Around her sophomore year, Teresa knew it was time to get out of Loyalton.
I'm pretty over this place. I'm ready to get out of here.
So she hatched a plan to graduate early. She stayed super busy with all the extracurriculars she needed to finish high school. An active kid already, she could manage a full schedule. And she did well. But things were going on all around her, both inside and outside of her home. The loneliness continued.
I felt increasingly alienated, I guess, from my friend group. You know, I felt like they were people who, not even that we didn't share the same values, but there was just this emphasis on religion and specifically purity culture, I would say, yeah, that did not really align or resonate with me at all. So I did what anyone would do, which is that I graduated early and moved to Thailand.
Though to the world, it was impressive she was spending time abroad. Teresa knew her motivations.
To me, deep down, I was like, oh, this is running away. I'm smart enough and I'm capable enough, thankfully, you know, that I'm able to run away in such a fashion that is legitimized, essentially. But like, make no mistake, I went to the furthest country I could go without coming back.
A place where the religion, values, you name it, were totally different. The experience was amazing. And strategic.
It would not be true to say that it was just this
adventure,
this lighthearted adventure, yeah, that I signed up for. You know, it definitely was me finding a clever way to get out, basically, get away.
This new life, planned and created at such a young age, made me wonder how her parents digested such a dramatic exit. Were they confused?
My mom was actually, she was the principal of my high school at the time, which really helped to know what I needed to do to navigate graduating early, to at least just from a logistical standpoint, right? There's kind of what the requirements are and all of these sorts of things. So she was really supportive.
Her dad, less so.
He was very concerned about me going to a non-Christian country, and it was something that he expressed. I think it was more challenging for him, but he also didn't stand in the way of it either.
So she went to Thailand, had an amazing experience. When she thought about returning home, she felt some resistance. There were things she was unprepared to face.
I did not want to come back. I kind of considered staying briefly. My visa was going to expire, so I would have had to go to Vietnam or Laos or something. I would have had to work it out to come back.
Not that this was the primary reason for her hesitation, but her father had met someone while she was away.
When I came home, I met my to-be stepmom for the first time. Not to say that that by any means was the reason I didn't want to come back, but there was just a lot happening in terms of my family that I felt not exactly ready to address. I was avoiding the trauma and the abuse that I had experienced as a child.
Specific experiences that we won't share in this episode.
I was running away, right? I was running away and I had this really wonderful, grand adventure. It was that right blend of like independence and adventure, but in this very safe container. And yeah, it was incredible.
So she wondered about staying there a bit longer rather than coming home and facing what she'd been running from. But there was joy, too.
I had gotten into UC Berkeley and I was very excited about that. So it's not like I wasn't looking forward to coming back. Or there wasn't anything I was looking forward to, but it was definitely just a complex environment to navigate coming home. And I think I knew it was going to catch up with me eventually, and it did.
Teresa came home and started her next phase of life in university. As she said, a significant mental health crisis occurred during her time at school. I asked her if she was comfortable talking about what had brought her to that point.
Yes. So I think there were a lot of things going on. You know, I had just gotten back from this year abroad. So I definitely think I had some amount of culture shock. And then, of course, you know, I was in my first semester at college. And so everything was like very new and very exciting and also a little scary. I think that three things really happened that sort of culminated in this moment.
The first was her ability to downplay or ignore the trauma she experienced as a child. During her time abroad, she felt bonded to her peers. All of them, globally diverse, were focused nearly entirely on navigating cultural differences within their own groups and their daily life.
Whereas coming to Cal, I felt like this was mostly kids from California, just like me. But of course, the kids I was surrounded by had had very different experiences growing up than I had. And I think that it was so in my face in a way that it hadn't been. I just couldn't ignore it anymore. I couldn't pretend that I hadn't grown up in the loneliest town in America. It is not a place that is foreign to poverty or that is foreign to addiction or trauma or abuse.
The second, no one could have predicted.
My first boyfriend, who I had dated while studying abroad, he was this really wonderful German exchange student. He passed away. So he died about a semester into my first year in college. You know, we definitely had left things like had not, we left things with things unsaid. As happens when you're 17.
Right.
And you just don't know that you're not going to get the chance to say those things, right, eventually.
And then her best friend, the first friend she made at college, was suffering through her own mental health challenges.
She had been diagnosed with bipolar disorder, and she was having some like acute mental health episodes where I was the primary support system for that. So, you know, without getting into too many details, you know, we're talking suicidal ideation, suicide, like some self-harm that was happening. And, you know, of course, now as an adult, I'm like, well, I would not navigate a situation like that alone. I would have better boundaries. I would call in help and support. And I didn't know any of that. I didn't know how to navigate any of that at the time. And all of this was happening in the span of a few months. It was all happening at the same time.
Without the support she didn't know she needed, Teresa compartmentalized and tried to carry on. She managed to make it to the first semester of her second year.
It's so funny. I can't remember what it was that actually set me off. It was something really small. Like, it ended up being a very minor disappointment that actually sent me over the edge. It was like a switch just turned off. I walked very calmly to the gas station that was near my apartment, and I got 3 packs of those like mint Milano cookies, you know, and I sat down and I ate them all in a single sitting, and then I just didn't stop. I didn't stop.
Time has passed since this moment in her life. Only recently has she developed the language to talk about it.
When I had that breakdown, part of my personality got turned off. And a different Teresa, a different part of my personality got turned on instantaneously. And it was this thing that was completely out of my control. But then once it happened, it's taken over a decade to unravel that doing. And it's been so hard to articulate what that experience is like, to just lose part of yourself almost instantaneously, like overnight, and to have it just go to this really shadowy like background of your mind and feel inaccessible for a really long time. It felt like it was overnight, right? Like all of a sudden I had major depression and major anxiety, and a big part of that was I also developed binge eating disorder. And that was doing a lot of heavy lifting, those binges, I would say, because it was both helping me self-soothe. So it was a form of emotional regulation, because I felt that I did not have healthy coping mechanisms or tools that I could access to deal with the very legitimately difficult emotions that I was grappling with at the time. You know, it got so bad that I couldn't go between 2 classes, my morning and my afternoon class, without like going to the grocery store and eating, you know, a full bag of food.
In the depths of her pain, she would create elaborate systems to minimize exposure. She was hitting up different grocery stores on alternating days, all to hide what she was doing. She felt very alone.
It's wild to look back on it, because the mental hijinks that I was going through to sort of hide what was going on. I think the big feeling that I felt at the time was I just felt like a freak. I felt like nobody my age understood what I was dealing with at all. Nobody I knew had had somebody really close to them die, you know, and most people I knew hadn't had childhood experiences like I had had, right? And it just was all, it all felt so disconnecting, and it just felt overwhelming. And I think along with that, especially with the eating, came so much shame. If you had told me that I would come on a podcast and just openly talk about
this wasn't your first idea back then.
No, it was not, you know. And I just felt so embarrassed about the whole thing. I didn't want people to see the full extent of how much I was struggling and how bad it had gotten.
Teresa thinks about this time in her life a lot. At the time, there wasn't much information or stories shared about this kind of disorder.
Binge eating disorder wasn't even recognized in the DSM until 2013.
For those listening, the DSM is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders.
Binge eating disorder is also the most prevalent eating disorder in the United States. By far, more people have binge eating disorder than anorexia or bulimia combined. So all this was happening pre-2013. It wasn't even considered a legitimate eating disorder yet. And so no wonder I felt like a freak a little bit.
Back then, the context about eating disorders shared, the movies made, and TV specials airing on Friday nights were almost exclusively a spotlight on circumstances that didn't look like hers.
And this is so sad and really messed up. But my thought at the time was like, well, I can't even do having an eating disorder right. All I had ever seen was that an eating disorder was anorexia, right? Maybe bulimia. So it wasn't it wasn't even on my radar as a legitimate way to be struggling with food, let alone, it turns out, I think the way that most people are struggling with food. I think that's what's so disheartening about it. I felt so isolated and alone in that experience. You know, I felt like I couldn't connect with anyone because I thought that nobody was going through the experience that I was going through.
When Teresa considers this, she realizes that her breakdown isn't actually where the story starts.
It is not as if I was perfectly fine and then I wasn't. It's like in serial killer stories where they're always like, they were so such a happy child and then they started murdering people.
And I'm
like,
were they?
I feel like maybe we should go back and unpack whether or not they murdered a few kittens too along the way. I was struggling for a long time before the breakdown. And I think that I was struggling in ways that were perhaps less visible, or I would also argue that are more lionized by society and deemed more acceptable.
Before Teresa suffered from binge eating, she would often restrict.
I mean, in that way, I do think no one noticed, right? I think it would be very difficult on my frame to be underweight. And I think that, I don't know for sure, but in my experience, it seems to me that what doctors are mostly looking for in teenage girls is if they're underweight or not. So it didn't matter that I didn't have a period and only briefly got a period as a teenager. And it didn't matter that I got so lightheaded that I passed out at the top of my stairs and fell down them and almost got a concussion, right? None of these things were, I guess, strong enough indicators that I was struggling, right? Yeah. You know, and I certainly when I had the breakdown, it was very clear. It was no longer a question, right? It was very much out there in the open, which I am sure on some level was my spirit's or my soul's way of crying for help and being like, please notice me, please see that this is happening.
During this time, Teresa's inner voice and her intuition were hushed, though present, softly reminding her that this cannot be all there is to her life. It was very hard to hear above her struggle. So she took a year off school, eventually returning and graduating. She remembers this era in her life and into the early years of her career were all about survival.
The ways I was struggling were showing up in the world. You know, I think that that was really the start of what I would say is like a long period of self-abandonment. It was survival mode to the extreme in this very animalistic sense. You know, I felt like I was just trying to like run to the next burrow and not get eaten by something. I think the thing that I knew even at the time was that this cannot just be it. This cannot be what my story is. I went from being this very high achieving kid, right, who managed to get into a really good school, sort of had all this potential. And then for it to feel like overnight, that just got ripped away from me in a way that I couldn't understand or couldn't even really articulate.
As time went on, this became Teresa's new normal. As she worked with therapists and psychiatrists alike, the outlook seemed bleak.
I think by my late 20s, it sort of felt like, well, is this just what it's going to be for me? That the best I can hope for is being a heavily medicated adult? That even with the increasingly higher dose of an SSRI and even with the sleeping pill, I'm barely holding down a job. Which is what it felt like. You know, it's like, this is giving me enough energy to get out of bed, to mask all day and pretend everything is fine at work, and then come home and collapse. That is not good enough. That is not good enough. You know, so I think that that is the piece where my voice still managed to come through.
She knew people were trying. The medical teams were doing what they could, working within the system and using the tools they had.
something I have learned in the process of going through this is how disjointed the medical system is and how constrained every modality is by the tools in their toolbox, right? So if you see a psychiatrist, they're going to give you meds, right? And if you see a therapist, they're going to want to talk it out with you, right? Like, we're kind of in a little bit of these silos. I wish somebody had sat me down and said, all of these symptoms you're experiencing, including the eating disorder, including the low self-esteem, including the self-abandonment, these are all really common symptoms of people who've experienced childhood trauma and have complex PTSD, or people who have experienced childhood trauma and whose nervous systems are stuck in a freeze and fawn mode and can't get out of it. To this day, there has never been a medical professional, God, certainly not a primary care physician, which is who I think ideally should be saying this. Ideally, right? I would say that my primary doctors were completely, completely separate from my mental health journey. They knew that I was on antidepressants at various times, right? Or was on medication. But beyond that, there was no connection. There was no linking up of ideas. I think for me, what really galvanized me, and I think that why I started on this health journey and took it so seriously, is that I think on some level I knew that if I did not find a way to address this, that I was going to die. It was going to kill me.
And she did take it seriously, but it took time. Some starts and stops. First, as we said earlier, she withdrew from school, hoping that would do the trick.
Nothing really changed. I basically took a year off hoping things would get better, and they didn't. And then I was like, well, what am I going to do? Just be sad on my mom's couch forever? That doesn't work, so I guess I'll go back to school.
Next, she began therapy. She knew she needed help, and at first it felt productive. But soon, Teresa found herself in a familiar cycle.
I think for a while I was going through these phases, again, because I just felt so... I just wanted to be normal, you know? I just wanted to have some normal goddamn 20-something experiences. And I felt like I kept getting locked out of that. I just felt so apart from all of my peers. So I would go through these cycles a bit where I would get enough stability, or I would get my mental health to a good enough place that I would be like, this is fine. I can work with this. Which eventually would catch up with me again, right? Because I had not dealt with the root issues.
Teresa had so many different symptoms. She had depression, insomnia, an eating disorder.
Those all came from the same place, which was trauma. It was from adverse childhood experiences, and it was from some trauma in the start of my college experience. And nobody could piece that together for me. I had to piece that together for myself. I'm so grateful that I've been able to do, but my goodness, it's so hard, so much harder than it has to be.
Teresa had to string together her experiences and identify the root problem before beginning the work. But as she said before, the silos make things so much more challenging than they need to be. Not everyone is able to connect the dots. Over a decade later, she finds haunting similarities between her mental health journey and the battle her mother has begun.
I'm watching my mom go through the same thing now as a person with an incurable cancer diagnosis. And it really strikes me how much we demand of patients that they have to be their own strongest advocates exactly at the time when they are the most under-resourced.
Think about that. You're already so depleted, scared, tired. Then you have to find the energy to show up for yourself. I asked her about her own years of feeling this way and if she could describe it for me.
I was underwater. That's how I would describe living with chronic depression and anxiety, is it felt like I was coming up and gasping for air. And before I could get a breath, I'd go back underwater again. And it was that for years. It was that feeling of not being able to like catch a breath. And somehow, as that is happening, you have to find the internal strength and reserves to be like, no, this isn't just a collection of symptoms. And no, I don't want to just be heavily medicated for the rest of my life. There has to be a way that I can work with my body and I can work with my own internal system and resources to heal on a deeper level than that. That has to be possible. And again, this is just my experience. I think the mental health care landscape in the United States is extremely fractured. So there might be people who have had more unified experiences than me. A lot of this is new. The Body Keep score came out in 2014. Binge eating disorder was added to the DSM in 2013. All of this was happening for me before that. I mean, I was right in the middle of it when that came around. I think having more trauma-informed practices is still very new. It's a very new idea, and it's sort of getting rolled out slowly. And I think what is so frustrating about this is that there seems to me to be still be such a stigma around all of this and such a lack of understanding.
When Teresa was in the depths of her depression, she felt weak. The perception of moral failure was always at her doorstep, and she leaned into unhealthy coping mechanisms to get by. Even to her, there was a right and wrong way to exist.
When I had been able to like keep things clamped down with my like perfectionism and my restriction and more of an orientation of control, that to me for a long time was like, well, that was when I was strong and that was when I was succeeding. And it was when, you know, I was had gained a lot of weight and was struggling with depression and felt like I had lost control, quote unquote, that was when I was failing. And I don't think I'm alone in that. Right? We get a lot of that messaging. I think that there's a lot of ways in which we put people on a pedestal who may actually have very unhealthy or very intense struggles with mental health as well, but it gets translated as societal success. We look at it as being better. But from a body perspective, from a nervous system perspective, from a bodily experience, that's not true. I think I spent so much time feeling really stuck in this place of being like, well, somebody else would have been stronger in the situation I was in, or they wouldn't have had a breakdown, or they would have been able to handle it more gracefully. And it is true that somebody else with the same stressors might not have reacted to it in the same way. But definitely, human bodies will react to trauma, they will react to chronic stress, and they will react to those things in ways that over time are really unhealthy.
10 years on, she has taken a more holistic approach. She acknowledges how her past had a genuine and very physical impact on her body. Though very much a work in progress, she feels her experience would have been different had her story started today.
There is starting to be more of an understanding of how trauma impacts the physical body. I've talked with therapists about the physical impact of trauma, but certainly at no point has a medical doctor been like, well, you know, we know that if you experience adverse childhood experiences specifically, that it shows up in physical manifestations long into adulthood, and it has prolonged health impacts for your entire life. And that is not just, quote unquote, mental illness. It doesn't just show up as depression or as eating disorders. I feel like some of my symptoms were pretty straightforward. Experienced trauma, had depression, that makes sense. But we know that trauma impacts physical health outcomes in all kinds of ways, in a variety of ways. And yet there's still this just huge, huge gap.
With her mother's diagnosis, she sees the same patterns of stigma, silos, and pressure to be your own advocate.
It's so interesting to watch the mirrors, you know, the ways that it feels similar. A couple things that come with lung cancer in particular. I think there is this assumption that gets made as soon as you get a lung cancer diagnosis, right? Which is that, oh, you must have been a lifelong smoker. That's why you have lung cancer. Turns out that there are tons of triggers for lung cancer. Smoking is one of them. In my mom's case, it was a genetic marker. She has a genetic mutation that predisposed her to lung cancer, right? And for a long time, because of that association with smoking, there was a huge lack of funding for lung cancer research. So lung cancer kills more people than any other type of cancer, yet it is one of the least funded. Medical professionals, when they first started meeting with my mom, so many of the doctors just spoke to her in just these quiet, whispered, really defeated tones, right? It's like, you're already dead. And that was something that I really felt as the struggle with mental illness became more protracted. And I don't know when exactly along the way, but somewhere along the way, it just sort of felt like it became, well, you're just somebody who struggles with depression, I guess. You know, I guess that is what it is for you. And it feels very similar for my mom. People treat her as if, well, you've gotten this diagnosis, so it's all over for you.
This is where the message of believing in yourself comes in. For Teresa, belief is a necessary prerequisite for achieving your goals. Her philosophy is simple. If you cannot believe it to be true or possible, then it won't.
Does believing that it's possible mean that it will happen for sure? No, definitely not. But if you don't think it's possible to have stage 4 lung cancer and survive and thrive, then you won't. It just, you won't make it, right? And I think, like, for me, if I did not believe that it was possible to heal my mental health symptoms, and if I did not believe that it was possible for me to live a healthy and happy life on some level, even if it felt a million light years away at the time, I don't think it would have happened. It's made me so, well, protective of my mom. When you tell people that you have this stage 4 cancer diagnosis, their immediate reaction is like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, right? And you kind of have to hold the line a little bit and push back and be like, actually, we're doing okay.
Through her own journey and now her mother's, Teresa challenges so many assumptions. She's had to.
It doesn't mean these things that you necessarily think means, you know, and it is weird to say, but it's really going well, weirdly. It doesn't feel like you should be able to say that, you know, when your mom has stage 4 lung cancer. But I think choosing to show up and stay in the present moment and not assume that we know what the reality is until it's actually in front of us has been so important for my mom and has made such a big difference.
Because of her genetic mutation, Teresa's mother will manage her cancer through medication, avoiding chemo and radiation. As she reflected on her mother's treatment plan, another similarity emerged.
I think that I've had this realization that all of my assumptions of what having cancer are actually based around chemo and radiation. And I think of what somebody looks like when they have cancer and what it means to have cancer and be really sick. What I'm actually thinking of is like the sickness and the side effects from chemo and radiation. In the same way that when I thought of what it meant to have an eating disorder was that you had to be anorexic and that I didn't have any ideas of what else it could mean.
During her mental health struggles, Teresa was committed to attaining a better outcome than what was presented to her. She brought that mindset and dedication to her mother's cancer journey, believing her battle could be different.
I have a sister who is 11, and it's just not an option for my mom to have a few months left to live, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's just not something that is acceptable in her reality. And so there has to be a way through where we can, in the constraints that we have and with the conditions that we're dealing with, can find success, right? Can really thrive in spite of or in some instances because of, weirdly, though it doesn't seem possible at the time, all of those challenges that are showing up.
Teresa is not kidding herself. Her belief rests firmly in what's possible, not miracles. She's there with her mom, doing the work, staying positive, researching, and moving forward. She shows up, something nearly impossible for her to do only a short time ago.
I think where things started to get better for me was around 10 years in. And it happened in phases, and it wasn't linear. 2018 was when I really came to terms with and admitted to myself trauma I had experienced was real and had really happened, you know, because I think that I had been in denial about that fact and didn't want to claim that truth, you know, that this was real. It happened. It happened to me. So I think that that was a big turning point.
Teresa's turning point came in late 2022. The pandemic helped to provide focus.
Like a lot of people, I just got so tired of feeling bad all the time. I think so many people were just like, I have felt bad for 3 years straight. And in my case, it had been for 10 years straight, you know, and I don't want to feel this bad anymore. I just don't. And I'm going to find a way to not.
She started taking her needs seriously and shook off some limiting beliefs she'd carried for a long time.
If I were stronger, then I wouldn't have reacted to this in the same way. But does that really matter? Do I not deserve health and happiness because I reacted to a trigger or a struggle in a weaker way than someone else? That seems pretty silly, actually.
So she put systems in place and aligned with people to help her stay accountable in areas where she was struggling.
To be honest, I put up really strong boundaries in lots of areas of my life. I had to really kind of cut off a lot of things that were negatively impacting me or were really triggering to me. And I included things like I don't really read the news anymore. You know, I said goodbye to relationships that weren't serving me. I said goodbye to jobs that weren't serving me. I think I like let go of a lot in that year. I think really the thing that changes, that ultimately changes, is just deciding you're worth it. And it's enough. Like wanting to be happy and wanting to be healthy is enough of a reason to get well. It's hard even now to articulate it to people because people in a really well-meaning way inadvertently gaslight you. When I was in college, overnight, everything just became hard, right? It became hard because I had had this breakdown. People all the time would be like, well, but you're at UC Berkeley and the coursework is really challenging. Don't you think it's because it's hard? And I was all too willing to go along with that narrative, right? Because I was this big fish in a very small pond. And to me, it fed into all of my like insecurities and imposter syndrome to be like, well, that must be it. It must just be that I've never actually been challenged before in terms of coursework. And that's why I can't write a term paper without eating a full bag of M&Ms to get through it.
These people that are outside of me, they know what's going on inside of me.
They know, right. And it took me years. You know, I feel like I'm only just now starting to get on the other side of this whole thing. And I'm starting to get some of my like core personality back. I'm able to say that is not the reason that it became hard.
No longer feeling weak, Teresa looks back on the last decade of her life with a new perspective, an appreciation.
Why did my body have a breakdown? Why did it choose to have a breakdown? It's like, well, it was trying to save you. I know it doesn't feel that way. I know it feels like it failed, but it was overloaded. It was overloaded with stress. It did what it thought would help you survive, which was to freeze and to fawn. It thought that that would help. It thought that if you just froze and fell over, that the bear wouldn't get you, right? And it was right. I feel so grateful to my body's ability to try and save me. And I feel so grateful to my mind's ability to have the capacity to understand when that system has gone off the rails.
You know what's so funny? I have this like visual of, you know, your body, you, your brain, the shadow Teresa that was born in that moment. And it's almost like this thing that you had wanted with your medical providers to form a team to help you was actually just always there within you. The team was there and it helped you that way internally.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's such a beautiful thought. And I think what I would say is that everyone has that. Everyone has that team. That's a universal truth, you know? And I think part of the reason that along this journey, I've become so passionate about listening to my intuition and trusting myself is that it's the thing you can control. There's so much that is outside of our control or just feels like it's happening to us. Certainly the medical system and navigating the medical system. But there is this internal source of power. There is this voice that you can tap into. It's always available to you. And you can be experimental or a skeptic about it. It's not that I necessarily went into trusting my intuition blind, but what happens if I follow it?
Listening to your inner voice can be intimidating. How accurate is it? Teresa says to test it, start small.
I was in the grocery store the other day, and in the back of my head, I was like, get pickles. And then I was like, that is just you being hungry. You don't actually need pickles. And then I didn't get them. And then the next night, we had hamburgers, and we ran out of pickles. And I was like, I should have gotten those pickles. Like, you can start with something really small, right, and just see what happens. And I can just tell you personally, I do not have a single example of a time that I listened to my intuition and regretted it.
When Teresa started her healing journey, began listening to her inner voice, and believed that things could be different for her, happiness still felt like an unattainable goal.
I just wanted some relief, frankly, from how difficult it was to have such low energy and such low moods and not be able to sleep and to like struggle with suicidal thoughts all the time. I just wanted some relief, some like physical relief, some mental relief.
But she believed it was possible. She demanded it, sought help, and connected the dots her team couldn't. She created her community and slowly, not linearly, found her way to today.
I've been off of medication for years. I'm in really good health. And most importantly to me, the thing that I'm most proud of is that I've been happy, legitimately happy, like every day for over a year at this point, you know? And I think if you had told me that 5 years ago, I would be like, you're lying. I just wouldn't have believed that it was possible and it was possible to like be consistently happy. So when I say I've been happy every day for a year, it's not in some sort of like toxic positivity way. You know, I still have moments where I feel really sad or really fearful or even really anxious, right? You know, I still feel the full range of human emotions. That, in fact, is the goal, it turns out. It's just that I never get so far away from being in a state of emotional regulation that it feels like I can't access it.
That was the thing. In those years following her breakdown, she was at capacity. In her attempt at survival, joy was secondary. She felt alone, like a freak, and less than for her response to the trauma she experienced. Happiness was inaccessible, but it wasn't her forever.
We've obviously met a few times talking about all of this, and the way in which you storytell this really dark and sad and scary and emotional journey that you've been on is somehow so inspiring and feels possible when you talk about it. So I really, really appreciate that. I wonder if you had to pinpoint an age or stage in your life, what gift would you give yourself?
Yeah, that was funny. I was kind of thinking about this because one of those, you know, Instagram story challenges came up recently that was tag yourself in with a picture of you at 21. And I never do those things, but for whatever reason, I was like, sure, like, let's go find a picture of me at 21. And up until I actually went looking, I hadn't even thought about it. But that was the year that I withdrew from college. And so, you know, it ended up being that there's exactly one photo of me from when I was 21. Exactly one. I think I would go back and I would tell her, I would tell that person, most of all, to believe in yourself, but really to believe yourself. It can be so easy to minimize or downplay our experiences, I think, especially as women. There's this really strong societal narrative that your pain doesn't matter, or your pain isn't even real, and you're weak for feeling it. There are so many examples of this, just so many instances where people don't believe that their own experiences are valid. And as a result, you know, I think I ended up getting stuck in a cycle of suffering that lasted as long as it needed to, but I believe could last a lot less time for other people. You know, I don't think it needed to take 13 years. So much suffering can either be avoided or just addressed so much more quickly if we just believe that it's real and believe that it's valid. When I was 21, I was so stuck in everything that I was going through that that idea would have seemed so foreign to me. But yeah, I would tell myself that what I'm feeling is real and it's valid, and to believe in it and believe that it's possible to heal from it.
A big part of what got Teresa through this challenging time and continues to act as her compass today is this vision of what could be true. Despite people telling her to settle with this life that felt less than, she would make it if she just held on to that.
Higher self, maybe, if you want to call it that, that I just wouldn't let go of.
And I'm so glad she didn't.
Whoever that is, whatever that version we all have, who our true selves are, who our highest self is, like, that's real, real. And take inspired action. There's no wrong place to start in the direction of making that person real, because I don't know, it's like it's all we have in some ways. Yeah. It's like it's all we have.
Thank you for this. I really appreciate you being here and sharing this story. And, you know, I think that there's just been so many really tangible examples that I shall chew on myself for a while. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's my pleasure. And yeah, thank you for having me.
Yay. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Story Goes, the podcast dedicated to highlighting the everyday and celebrating the moments that shape us. The music was composed by Daniel G. Harmon, who also edits and produces this thing. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on my show, reach out to me directly at sophia@gifted.work. Thanks for listening.